Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you had a wonderful weekend. Great to be with you today. We have much conversation in the second hour about Governor Newsom signing the bill. You just heard the story on NPR's Hourly News about the state of California starting in 2023, allowing athletes at the college level to be able to do endorsement deals, to hire agents. The NCAA says this would totally upend the way that college athletics operates. So we'll talk about the potential legal positions of the two sides on that. That's coming up in our second hour. But we begin this hour with the very latest on the impeachment inquiry. As you just heard on NPR News, depositions and closed-door interviews are scheduled to take place throughout the course of this week. Last week, we had Devin Nunes, a California Republican member of Congress and the ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee, criticizing Democrats over the impeachment inquiry.
The complaint relied on hearsay evidence provided by the whistleblower. The inspector general did not know the contents of the phone call at issue. The inspector general found the whistleblower displayed arguable political bias against Trump. The Department of Justice investigated the complaint and determined no action was warranted. The Ukrainian president denies being pressured by President Trump. So once again, this supposed scandal ends up being nothing like what we were told. And once again, the Democrats, their media mouthpieces, and a cabal of leakers are ginning up a fake story with no regard to the monumental damage they're causing to our public institutions and to trust in government.
That's the Republican position, or at least the majority of Republican members of Congress position, as laid out by the ranking leader, House Intelligence Committee ranking member, Devin Nunes. And then the chair of that committee, Democratic Representative Adam Schiff of Burbank, was on This Week with George Stephanopoulos on ABC yesterday morning.
I intend to hold the president accountable, and I intend to do a thorough investigation. And what we have seen already is damning, because what we have seen in that call record is a president of the United States use the full weight of his office with a country beholden to America for its defense, even as Russian troops occupy part of its land. And the president used that opportunity to try to coerce that leader to manufacture dirt on his opponent and interfere in our election. It's hard to imagine a series of facts more damning than that. And so, yes, we're going to get to the bottom of it.
Kevin Whitelaw, deputy managing editor at Bloomberg, joining us to talk about the latest developments. Kevin, good morning. Let's start first with what's scheduled this week. Do we know specifically who's going to be interviewed?
Well, you know, this is a week where Congress is actually technically off, but the House Intelligence Committee has stuck around and is planning to hold a set of closed door depositions. So they have scheduled a number of the players who have been involved in the named in these things, including the former Ukraine envoy, former ambassador, and others to come in starting Wednesday. What we don't actually know is who's going to show up. So these folks haven't actually been subpoenaed yet. They have simply been asked to come in. So in theory, we'll have to see what happens. It's all behind closed doors. It would start on Tuesday with the former ambassador to Ukraine. This is someone that the president disparaged in the phone call, the transcript of which has since been released. The former Ukraine ambassador, Kurt Volker, is scheduled for Thursday. He's made indications he plans to attend. We don't actually know, however, really how many questions they're going to be able to answer. We don't know if the White House will try to exert any form of executive privilege over any of their answers, whether they're going to demand that someone is from the U.S. government, the Justice Department, or elsewhere, is present with them, tell them what they can answer, what they can't answer. So it's there's a ton of uncertainty, and given that it's all going to play out behind closed doors, we're very likely to get extremely varying accounts from the Republicans and Democrats in the room about what actually transpired.
Kevin, I haven't seen anything from the president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, about whether he would be willing to speak if he's subpoenaed. Have you seen any response to that question?
He's kind of given answers on both sides of that. So I don't think we have a clear sense of exactly what's going to happen or how quickly the committee might make a decision on that. There's questions about Giuliani. There's questions about the attorney general, given that his name was brought up in the conversation that Trump had with the Ukrainian president. There's also questions about the whistleblower, and negotiations are still ongoing about whether the whistleblower is going to meet with Congress at some point amid varying intensive efforts from different parties to try to either protect the whistleblower's identity or to expose it.
Well, and the whistleblower doesn't have firsthand knowledge. He or she filed the whistleblower complaint based on what the filer says were multiple individuals who described this conduct by the president. Has there been talk of attempting to bring in the people who spoke with the whistleblower and who provided the firsthand information?
I mean, there's definitely interest in doing that. I think there is a bit of a question about how, what are the mechanics of that, particularly whether or not the whistleblower is willing to divulge those names. They were not included in the versions that were released to the public, obviously, in the complaint or in the report. And I don't think we know whether the whistleblower provided any of those names, even in a classified or other private kind of fashion. So that's one of the many questions we don't have an answer to yet.
Yeah, because otherwise it would just seem that the questioning of the whistleblower might be kind of a dead end if that individual's not willing to share the names of the person who shared it, which would be understandable if that person didn't. And the extent of what they know might be contained in the complaint itself.
That's right. Although, obviously, you know, there's enough specifics laid out about how the call records were handled and other things in terms of these allegations that you could certainly go to the various officials with responsibility for these various tasks that were described and ask them under oath, in theory, you know, about what they know related to this phone call. So whether that was directly the sourcing or not, it's unclear. But obviously, a lot of what was in the letter has turned out to have subsequently been validated, particularly the account of this phone call. The whistleblower did not have firsthand knowledge, but assembled what turned out to be a reasonably close description and summary of how what transpired in that phone call.
Congressman Adam Schiff, who chairs the House Intelligence Committee, when he began with his statement last week in the hearing in which he laid out the case for impeachment, he did a kind of a caricature of the phone call that the president made, and that's made him a target of the president and supporters of the president. The president going so far as to refer to it as, you know, potentially treasonous. What has there been any backlash from other Democrats for what Schiff did in that opening, as opposed to keeping it to what the president actually said in the call?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't heard it out in public. I'm sure there was a certain amount of cringing because, you know, on some level, I think a lot of Democrats felt the call was troubling enough that it didn't need to be exaggerated. I think overall, Democrats are reasonably happy that Adam Schiff is the one sort of taking the current leading role as opposed to some of the other committees. It's sort of natural, just given the jurisdiction of the committee and where this complaint's coming from. But there had already been in three committees involved. And so the Democrats do have some ability to theoretically sort of pivot between who takes the lead. And for now, I think Schiff definitely has that. I think the more urgent concern on the part of Democrats has to do with Trump's comments about the whistleblower and that he really deserves to know the identity of who the whistleblower is. And he's, you know, partisan motivated, et cetera. And you've seen some Republicans in Congress start to echo that as well. That kind of goes very much against longstanding practices about protection of whistleblowers and their identities in laws that have been written and passed by both Democrats and Republicans. So you definitely have seen some Democrats, including ranking Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, Mark Warner, start to stand up and condemn Trump for those remarks.
Also, before we let you go, Kevin, I wanted to ask you about the whole issue of Joe Biden here and you know, potential damage to his candidacy because of all this focus on Hunter Biden. And What are Democrats saying about, is there concern over what Hunter Biden did, even if, you know, there was no malfeasance in him serving on the board, just the conflict of interest that potentially represents while his father is the point person with Ukraine?
That's a good question, and I think that a lot of it depends on who you are in the Democratic Party and whether you are looking to support Joe Biden in the election or whether you're looking to support or whether you are one of his opponents. And obviously, his opponents have all treated this a little carefully with, you know, sort of in the form of, well, this is really, really bad what the president's doing. But, you know, my family would never do anything like that, kind of a vein. So, this obviously hits Biden at a time where his polls were already sinking a little bit, so he's a little vulnerable. We'll have to see whether he's able to bounce back from it. Other Democrats are not pouncing on this, but, for the most part, I think they're trying to avoid it. I'm not sure they've really wrestled with the question, however, of the deeper they get into an impeachment investigation, if they're going to make this look fully credible and real and serious. At some point, do they have to bring in Hunter Biden? Do they have to bring in Joe Biden? I'm not really sure that they've fully addressed that in their heads yet in the logic. That could obviously prove pretty awkward for Democrats and for the primary itself.
And, Kevin, just about 5 hours ago, President Trump tweeted, "Who changed the longstanding whistleblower rules just before submittal of the fake whistleblower report? Drain the swamp." The president referring there to the allegation that hearsay whistleblower reports were not accepted prior to this rule change that occurred not long before the current whistleblower filed the report. Do you have any confirmation if that's true?
As best we can tell, it's not. This seems to have come from started off as a report in a conservative outlet and was based on the fact that a form at some point along the way for whistleblowers changed the rules themselves, the governing what kinds of things can be considered a whistleblower complaint haven't changed. And the form appears to be an attempt to clean up some confusion on a previous form as opposed to anything that's actually different. Secondhand accounts have long been part of whistleblower complaints.
Kevin Whitelaw, Bloomberg's deputy managing editor for U.S. government. Thank you for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We're very pleased to have with us our political analyst, Pete Peterson, Dean of the School of Public Policy at Pepperdine and Senior Fellow at Pepperdine University's Davenport Institute. Also joining us, former member of the DNC Unity Reform Commission, Nomiki Konst, who worked to increase participation, particularly among younger voters in the Democratic Party, and to reform the Democratic primary process. She was a former Bernie Sanders surrogate back in 16. Nomiki, Pete, good to have you both with us. Pete, let me start with you and how President Trump has been responding largely on Twitter to the impeachment campaign. Do you think he's launching an effective defense?
Well, I think the attacks on the whistleblower, as you pointed out in this last segment, are not politically helpful, but are all predictable. I mean, if there's anything predictable about this president is that when attacked, he will strike back. And if I were to somehow try to put myself in his shoes, which is an excruciatingly difficult thing to do, I would feel that if this whistleblower who in his report noted that several sources within the government had provided this information to him or her, that he or she is at the center of a number of different connections inside the White House, or at least in the intelligence community, of people who are spreading rumors about the president. And so in some ways, this is not so much an attack, I would see his argument being, not so much attack on the whistleblower, but about the process through which this person heard from several different sources about this particular phone call and how that happened.
But the president has he began, if I'm not mistaken, that private event last week by going after the people who allegedly talked to the whistleblower, then expanded that to going after the whistleblower directly. And not that the president is known for being highly targeted when he goes on the offensive like this, But does this sort of then confuse the argument he's trying to make about leaks within the White House?
Yeah, I do. I think it does. I think if the president were to step forward and say, I want to find out exactly who was who within the administration or within the intelligence services were providing these leaks, that would be one thing to go after and to make it apparent, as you say, in this last these last tweets about going after the whistleblower directly. I don't think is politically advantageous, but is a part and parcel of the continued reactivity of this president.
We'll hear from Nomiki Konst as we continue. That's Pete Peterson, the dean of Pepperdine's School of Public Policy. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We have much to talk about with the impeachment inquiry, but also a new poll out of UC Berkeley, which shows conservative Californians are far more likely to consider moving out of state. If they followed through and did that, what would be the economic impact on California? We'll talk about that back in a minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Just a reminder that announcement was made this morning. Governor Gavin Newsom signed the bill that was passed unanimously out of the state legislature, allowing college athletes at four-year schools to be able to hire an agent and for those athletes to be able to do endorsement deals, profit off their image and likeness. But right now we're talking about the impeachment inquiry. Nomiki Konst with us, former member of the DNC Unity Reform Commission. Nomiki, good morning. My first question for you is, do you feel like the Democratic majority of the House is taking the best approach in pursuing the impeachment inquiry?
I think what's difficult about this is we have an election year next year where, you know, it's not just that there's a presidential election and several primaries and we're in the middle of the primary process, but we also have congressional elections where they have primaries and, of course, a few Senate seats that are up that could turn the Senate Democrat if we end up sticking to the right strategy. You know, the fear I think a lot of folks, especially progressives, have is that if we focus too much on Trump and impeachment, we may not be able to win these congressional seats because we're not focusing on things like economic injustice or, you know, the deeper issues that are affecting communities across the country. You know, you see Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, who've been a little bit questioning the strategy of focusing entirely on Trump because, you know, when you go down into the districts, people aren't talking about Trump. They're talking about the fact that they can't afford their health care or they're, you know, debt ridden because of student loans. It's much deeper when you actually go out into the field. But with that being said, you know, in the last week alone, since they've done the polls on the impeachment, the majority of Americans have now, it's now 49%, we're split, are in favor of moving towards an impeachment inquiry. 43% want impeachment of Americans. And of course, the president's disapproval is around 54% right now. So the numbers are moving in favor of impeachment. And just one more note on that. I think what you're hearing from a lot of politicians who are critical is they'll mention Clinton and how it hurt Clinton in the end. But that's really our only case study. And the circumstance was entirely different at the time. So I always caution folks that this is a difficult dance. If we stick to the issues that affect communities, as we do in these primary states where you see all the candidates going out on the trail and talking about things like Medicare for All and the differences between all their plans, if we stick to that and we stick to impeachment, I think we'll be okay. I think it'll be good for the Senate. I think it'll be good for Congress. And I think it'll be good for the presidency.
Nomiki, I'm interested in Pete's thoughts on that. Nomiki talking about, you know, this very different. We have the only, you know, recent years case study here in the Clinton case. Do you think that they are different enough? There's not necessarily a lesson to learn from House Republicans' impeachment of Clinton.
Pete, you're asking me, Larry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Well, I think the timing is different, right? I mean, I think this obviously the Clinton impeachment was after that, the second election. And obviously we are heading into a reelection campaign. So I think that to Nomiki's good point, we don't have a lot of history. And even the history that we do have isn't politically relevant. So I don't know that we really do know how it's going to impact the races next year. I would say, in going into the polling data, which I'm believing Nomicki is referring to the PBS Maris poll,
NPR,
if you go underneath some of the polling data, it is very fractured. I mean, it is almost completely a party line vote that breaks us to what is currently a slightly over 50% support of moving forward, not with impeachment, but with an impeachment inquiry, right? It's being reported out there. I've seen some reports that over 50% support impeachment. And that was not the question that was asked in that poll. But when you delve a little bit deeper and you look at those all-important independents, actually a majority of the independents do not support moving forward even with the inquiry. And below that, when you look at the qualities of strongly approve and strongly disapprove, a plurality of independents strongly disapprove of moving forward even with the inquiry. So obviously some things can come out, but as it stands with the most comprehensive survey data that we have, it is very much of a division between Republicans and Democrats.
EGW writing on our AirTalk page, NPR elites would be having a different tone if Don Jr. was the one getting $50,000 a month from Ukraine. Pete, do you think that there is a double standard between Hunter Biden apparently profiting off of his father's profile and what other relatives of elected officials do?
Well, I can't speak comparatively, but what I can say it has been shocking that nobody has put a microphone in front of Hunter Biden. I have not heard him make a single comment about this. And when you look at his resume and you look at the responsibilities that he was tasked with this Burisma company, there doesn't seem to be any connection there. That would seem to be one of the last people that you would bring on to the board. And that $50,000 a month payment for board membership, it just stinks to high heaven.
And can you think of other examples where we've had family members who've done this kind of thing, essentially ridden the coattails of the prominent family member?
Well, I'm thinking back to Billy Carter, although I don't even remember that Billy was
he had his own beer.
He had his own beer, right, but it wasn't directly connected. You know, I'm reading the biography, the Chernow biography of U.S. Grant and some of the shenanigans played there by Grant's own father in trying to parlay his son's efforts in the Civil War into military contracts benefiting him. You know, this certainly there is some history there, but this just seems to be so dramatically disconnected from what Biden's background is and the fact that the vice president, the former vice president, was lead in the Ukraine relationship. It just does not make any sense.
Nomicki, your thoughts about Hunter Biden's position. It'd be so interesting to know if the two Bidens had a conversation over this and if Joe Biden had expressed any concern over his son holding this position. But do you think this is an outlier or fairly common in politics?
I mean, it's case by case, obviously. The New York Times, when they wrote their first investigation, I think 3 or 4 years ago, it was interesting because they actually illustrated in that investigative report, when it was first reported on, that Hunter Biden's his role was actually in opposition to Joe Biden's advocacy there, which was very fascinating. And I think we'll learn more about that as we go. But, you know, is it uncommon? I hate to bring this up. And this is, I think, what Donald Trump wants to illustrate is a butter email situation. I think, you know, Donald Trump is trying to create the narrative that he had in 2016, which was running against this entrenched establishment that, you know, the Clinton Foundation and all the work that they're doing. And it's like the right wing takes an ounce of truth and turns it into something, a narrative, a political narrative that is conspiratorial, often false, and leads to many investigations that go nowhere. You know, is it true that Hunter Biden did this? Yes. Is it ethical? That's questionable. Is it illegal? That's for us to figure out. But I think what Donald Trump is doing, which you were alluding to earlier, going after the whistleblower, at the end of the day, the transcripts are the transcripts. So he can go after the whistleblower and he can make a political case, you know, that there are snakes in the White House, you know, going against him. But they're going against him because he quite possibly is breaking the law. And that's why we have these systems in place, to make sure that, you know, whistleblowers are protected, which they should be in the U.S., and that our government is acting on behalf of the U.S., Americans' interests.
And, Namiki, you're really getting, I think, to the core of this issue, at least is where we stand right now, is that the majority of Democrats look at the transcript of that phone call and see not just something that was unethical and inappropriate for the president to do, but reaching the threshold of the high crimes and misdemeanors, that it reaches an impeachable offense. And I think that, at least given what I was hearing from NPR reporter Tamara Keith this morning, she's saying Republican elected officials were essentially saying to her, look, the president shouldn't have done this. This wasn't right. But we don't see it as rising to the level of impeachment. I mean, is that kind of the crux of where we sit, Nomiki?
I think as of right now, for the public, probably. I mean, we'll see. And of course, these hearings are going to be behind closed doors, which is another thing to factor in. It's being mentioned that this by the end of the year, we will know whether or not we move forward with full on impeachment. If these hearings were to be conducted publicly, something tells me it would be dragged on a little bit longer throughout the presidential primary process. And of course, you know, we'll learn through this process whatever information can be released. But, you know, the other aspect, I heard a legal scholar mentioning this on CNN the other day, is that this could be evidence towards the greater investigation. And I mean, there's so much of the investigation that we're just not aware of, that this could be, you know, coloring a larger case against the president.
Nomiki Konst with us, Pete Peterson of Pepperdine University joining us. Pete, your thoughts about Nomiki's comments there.
Well, I think she's right in the sense, and certainly the polling does bear this out, that this is a split between how you perceive the transcript. As someone who has called out the president in the past, and I think, Larry, you and I have talked about the fact that I actually voted for Ronald Reagan in 2016, I just don't see it. I do not see it in this transcript that this would be an impeachable offense. I mean, to conflate some of this do me a favor with the Biden inquiry is not factually accurate. But also the part, and Senator Rob Portman has borne this out, the constant drumbeat that the president has been making about making sure other EU and European countries are fulfilling their international obligations has been something in Trump's history for decades. And calling out Germany in particular, and Angela Merkel in this phone call, and the withholding of the military aid based on his feeling that the other countries were not doing their part, is completely consistent with where the president has been on relationships between the European countries. And to go from there to this, I really do think that this is a bridge too far.
We're going to have to take a break, but we'll pick it up. But what I wanted to ask you, Pete, is, you know, at the time that the money was withheld, did the president say, I'm withholding the money because we're not going to be, you know, paying when others aren't doing their fair share? I certainly understand what you said, that this has been a long-running theme with President Trump. We'll talk more, though, about the specifics of the withholding of aid to Ukraine. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Back with more from Pete Peterson and Nomiki Konst right after a live update from Hedy Lyn Herdes. Coming up next hour on Air Talk, California leading the pack again. Governor Newsom announcing this morning that he signed legislation allowing students at four-year colleges who are athletes to be able to sign with agents and to do endorsement deals. This runs right in the face of NCAA rules. The NCAA has even indicated it might disqualify California schools from being part of the organization if this new law goes into effect in 2023. We'll talk about that next hour. Right now, it's politics with Nomiki Konst, who is a former member of the DNC Unity Reform Commission. She was a Bernie Sanders surrogate in 2016, and Pete Peterson, Pepperdine University's dean of the School of Public Policy. So, Pete, just following up where we were before our update, I'm a little unclear about some of the timing and communication on this nearly $400 million in aid that Trump blocked after Congress had appropriated it for this purpose. Because we've had the president of Ukraine and other officials, to my knowledge, say they weren't aware that the funding had actually been blocked. I hadn't heard that the president at the time it was blocked say this was because Europeans hadn't come forward with money and the president thought it wasn't right for the U.S. to free this up before Europeans committed to more funding. What do we know about the timeline and who was communicated what about these funds?
Well, we don't know. We just have learned within the last day that apparently the Ukrainian president Zelensky did not know the funds had been held up. What we at least have a window into is Senator Portman, who spoke over the weekend about this, did indicate that this was the reason for the holding up of the funds. Certainly in the phone call, and I'm just going to read here directly from the transcript, the president, after the initial nicety, says, "We spent a lot of effort and a lot of time, much more than the European countries are doing, and they should be helping you more out than they are. Germany does almost nothing for you. All they do is talk, and I think it's something that you should really ask them about. When I was speaking to Angela Merkel, she talks Ukraine, but she doesn't do anything." So, I mean, to say that, again, if this moves forward into the actual impeachment process, you're going to have to prove that these funds were held up for the reason of trying to gain some sort of political advantage. And at least from this transcript and from what Senator Portman has said, there is very much reason to believe that the holding up of funding was related to his ongoing issues around the lack of European support within Europe and the EU nations for Ukraine.
So that's clearly a legitimate issue. And you even, you know, point out historically this is where Donald Trump has been. But then, of course, there also is the portion of the transcript that relates to the activities of Joe and Hunter Biden. Nomiki Konst, your thoughts about whether that's going to be a plausible defense of the money was held up because the Europeans weren't doing their share?
I think in response to this being Trump's history and his belief, that's exactly the point. The fact that he does have a belief in this, I mean, he does operate quid pro quo. I believe it was Giuliani went on air the other day and said, this is how Trump makes deals. Well, that's exactly the point.
But the quid pro quo, that's common in these kinds of back and forth between countries, right? The issue is it a personal political quid pro quo that's being asked for, or is it something that's a national benefit?
Well, I think a little bit of both. I mean, even his criticism of Angela Merkel and asking, you know, this isn't quid pro quo, but the way that he says to the president of Ukraine that please tell Angela Merkel that, you know, you have this problem with her. It's a form of manipulation in a way. You know, he's holding this money above his head, knowing that he'll do the dirty work for him. Of course, it's going to be extremely hard to prove. And that's why, you know, we're going to learn.
But I thought that kind of stuff goes on. I thought let me go back to you, Pete. Is that even an ethical concern if he's doing that?
Well, yeah, and we have Vice President Biden on videotape from a little over a year ago saying that he did the exact same thing, right? That he held up $1 billion in aid unless a certain prosecutor was fired. Now, you could make the argument, as I'm sure the former vice president would, is that we are not going to be giving money to countries that are corrupt. And obviously the vice president, the then vice president's argument was, we are not going to give $1 billion into a corrupt system. But I mean, to say that these kinds of negotiations of holding up funds for certain reforms, not personal benefit, but certain reforms to be happening, I mean, that's gone on for centuries.
All right, let's move on to talk about the politics here with the 2020 presidential candidates. Andrew Yang is in Southern California for the next couple of days. He's going to be on Air Talk tomorrow with guest host Libby Denkman. Nomiki, your thoughts about the strategies that the lower tier candidates are trying to employ. Yang seems to be trying to go, energize younger voters. But it seems to me that maybe the avenue here is to be the backup, to try and get into the backup of the moderate Biden territory. Does it make sense to you that Yang is courting younger voters?
I don't know if his goal at this point is necessarily to win the presidential primary or to cut into Biden supporters to take over his base. I think Andrew Yang is unusual given that he's not a political animal. He's not somebody who's been in office. So I'm not even sure if he's there. You know, what happens in these races, these multi-way races, historically, is other people in the race will realize that their chances are not as strong as they were before, and they'll start cutting deals. I mean, that's essentially how politics works, right? They pull the curtain back, and, if this person advances forward and this third tier or second tier candidate, does well and endorses that person, then perhaps that person will be on a ticket with them or will be nominated to a position, ambassadorship, to a cabinet if that person wins in exchange for the endorsement. I think Andrew Yang is an outlier in that he is not, an existing senator, an existing congressman. So I don't really know what his future goals are. He seems very focused on, the universal basic income. And the rumblings behind, there have been a few blogs about this, about how he's building his list for another venture. That would be a very interesting question to ask him. What are your goals if you do not win?
Yeah, exactly. Excellent point. Pete Peterson, as you look at the strategies of the lower tier candidates, are there any of them that you think are taking the right tack, just not getting traction?
Yeah, it continues to be that top three, and as has been said, I think it's fair to say that you would think that there might be someone who would slip into that more moderate role. I think Biden, though, in some ways, Biden's popularity is not really so much tied to his perceived moderation. It really is because of his name ID and his connection to President Obama. When you look out over the voter polls for the first few primary states, we've obviously seen some shifts happen in Iowa and New Hampshire, but Biden is very much leaning and still has a commanding lead in the South Carolina poll. And so the African-American support, which is such a pivotal demographic within the Democratic voter base, is still very much in Biden's camp. But I wonder if moving towards the center, it really would grab any of the Biden voters, because I don't think that really is the appeal that Biden has been receiving.
That's interesting. And but clearly for the progressive candidates, it is the political ideology and then the personal differences candidate to candidate. And it sounds like you don't really see critical mass within the Democratic Party to support a moderate candidate in the same way Elizabeth Warren seems to be the leading progressive candidate.
Not in the primary. Again, we have to remember that that primary voters are different than general election voters. And the primary voter, whether you're on the left and right, tends to be more ideological. And certainly the candidates that appear to be succeeding just on their own policy arguments are coming from the pretty far left. This has been a trend I know that we've talked about on this show many times, Larry. And I think that, again, the draw that Biden is receiving, if he had the same suite of policy issues but were a different candidate, who didn't have this vice presidential connection to President Obama, I don't think he'd be within 20 points of the lead.
Well, given the popularity of President Obama, as exhibited by Joe Biden, be interesting to see if he makes a recurrence thematically, if he reappears in a general election, or if the nominee is progressive to the point where raising President Obama would be deemed a negative. Would that person be able to tie in to the former president? You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We'll be back with more with Nomiki and Pete in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle with Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine University School of Public Policy and a senior fellow at Pepperdine's Davenport Institute. Nomiki Konst was a surrogate for Bernie Sanders in the last presidential election, and she was a member of the DNC Unity Reform Commission, which was looking to reform the Democratic primary process. We're getting both of their thoughts about the latest political developments. Nomiki, Kamala Harris continues to have a difficult time garnering support, including here in California, where she continues to trail even among African-American voters to Joe Biden. Do you see any avenue for her? And I'm wondering also, this might be affecting her fundraising at this point.
Yeah, I think this is a real question. Unless you're in that top three, Biden, Warren, and Sanders, right now it seems as if the fundraising is struggling for a lot of these candidates, and they've even been transparent about it. Senator Harris hasn't, but you know, there
Cory
have been
Booker, quite, yeah, talked
Cory
about
Booker's
dropping.
Been extremely. Julian Castro, same thing. They've been extremely transparent about not having the funds to make it on the debate stage. You know, Senator Harris, I think she's probably thinking what's next after this, and what. I mean, if I were advising her, I can see her being on the ticket with possibly all three of the candidates. I think she'd be a great she'd add a lot of gravitas and strength to Biden, Warren, or Sanders. You know, the thing about these races, especially when there's so many, is it really comes down to, you know, how strong your field is, how strong your operation was 2-3 years in advance. You know, Senator Warren was thinking about running last time around. Obviously, Joe Biden has run many times, and he has a lot of the institutional players from the Obama campaign, and Bernie Sanders didn't seem to ever shut down his campaign. So, you know, they've had operations on the ground in many of these states for a long time. And, you know, Senator Sanders, here's an example. He's trailing in some of these other polls with, you know, Iowa and New Hampshire, where he did extremely well last time. And, you know, last time around, we never really got around California. They called it before the night before the primary, and he's in some polls, you know, winning in California. The majority of polls last week came out said he was winning in California, but it's still very tight. So this election could be decided in the first three primary caucus states, but and that could influence the later elections by a couple of percentage points. So whoever does well in New Hampshire, whoever does well in Iowa, if they take them all, then they're probably the nominee, and they're going to win in California. They're going to win in New York. They're going to win in the rest of the state, South Carolina. That's how I think people are taking it.
All right. Pete, quick comment on that, and then I want to pivot to this poll about people considering leaving California.
Yeah, I completely agree with Nomiki. I mean, the primaries are an iterative process. What happens in Iowa can affect what happens in New Hampshire and so on. And it's obvious when you look at least the Real Clear policy averages that whatever happens within a couple points between Warren and Biden in Iowa could easily affect what happens in New Hampshire. I don't think there's much of a doubt there. It would take a dramatic collapse for Biden still to lose North Carolina. He's up by over 20 points as it stands currently, but that's his firewall.
Pete, I wanted to ask you about this UC Berkeley Institute of Governmental Studies poll that was conducted for the LA Times, came out last week, and showed that Republicans and conservative voters were nearly three times as likely to have seriously considered moving from California as Democratic or liberal residents. 40% of conservative / Republican voters to 14% Democratic / liberal Californians. For conservative voters, their concerns, taxes and the political climate of California. If those conservative / Republican residents were to flee because of housing prices and or politics, what do you think would be the economic effect of that? And the reason I ask that, because I think of disproportionately entrepreneurs and small business owners falling into that political camp.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know many of them, Larry. I remember when I was running back in 2013, 2014, I would call up my list of Republican donors who had given over many decades only to find out that they had moved to Florida or Texas or out of state. So I could see this trend happening back 3 or 4 years ago. The broader economic impact is tough to see, but I think what is really profound about this study is that about half of Californians more broadly had considered this. And at the same time, younger voters in particular, mostly due to housing costs, have considered leaving the state. So I think one of the underlying pieces here could be, at least as I think about possible future political impacts, what about the independents who tend to lean left, who tend to be younger voters, so many of them tending to think about leaving as well? How could that balance out the Republicans leaving the state? And it's hard to see, but it is distressing. And I would think that the governor's office would have to take note of this to see how many Californians more broadly have thought about leaving the state because of these economic and pocketbook issues.
And there is still a significant influx of people to California. Presumably, these are individuals who are coming for jobs here, because otherwise, if you're coming on spec, good luck in affording the state. Nomeki, your thoughts about what this survey reveals?
I think it's revealing, as has been stated already, that the economic situation is not what we see in terms of Wall Street, right? I mean, God bless him, the former president, President Obama, campaigned on a great economy and turning the economy around. But I don't think that process was ever finished. Income inequality is the greatest it's ever been since 1929. Housing costs are higher than they've ever been. The wages are historically low. I mean, this is hitting people in big cities and small communities, but it's not just in California. You're seeing the same trend in New York. So this, the states that used to represent, left-leaning America, people are fleeing them because they can't afford to live there. Big businesses are moving in and they're offering higher paid jobs, whether it's in the in the Valley, in the Silicon Valley, or with Amazon in New York. I mean, these are the businesses that are coming, and the small businesses and low wage workers are not able to sustain themselves, because with those businesses comes the housing cost. The Amazon deal in New York was also a real estate deal. All these high rises were built up around, and a lot of the protests happening around Amazon were because people couldn't afford the housing costs. The workers couldn't afford housing costs, low wage workers. And you're seeing the same thing in California and all major cities in America.
Nomeki Kantz joining us. Thank you very much, Nomeki. We appreciate it. Former member of the DNC Unity Reform Commission and a Bernie Sanders surrogate in the last presidential election. Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine School of Public Policy and Senior Fellow at the Davenport Institute. And Pete mentioning his candidacy last time, that was for California Secretary of State in 2014. Pete, good to have you with us, as always. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up in the second hour, way away from politics, but also important. The Dodgers go into the playoffs this week. They start on Thursday. They'll find out tomorrow night who their opponent will be starting Thursday at Dodger Stadium. We reconvene the triple play. Nick Roman, A. Martinez, yours truly, will be coming up later next hour.